Hello and welcome back to Hacker Slacker. I'm Jacob Petticord.
And I'm Andre Garive.
And we are happy to be back. It's been a little bit.
Back in Seattle. We both left Seattle for the 4th, but we are both back, doing better than ever. We are back at work and back on the podcast.
We haven't taken a week off in a while, I don't feel like. Like Christmas or something?
Well, it might have been between school and internship time, maybe a couple months ago, but... been doing pretty consistent. I think that's pretty good for us.
Yeah, so a lot has happened since we've been gone, so we are jam-packed with news, and then some news I keep hearing about around the use of facial recognition technology
by the government. Yeah, I've been seeing this a lot.
Yeah, it keeps bubbling up, so I figured I'd do a little deep dive into it, and we'd talk about kind of what that is all about. So we'll have that for you for our main topic today.
Yep.
So first, we've got some follow-up. Basically, if you remember, 2 weeks ago, the big topic was Johnny Ive leaving Apple. And so there was a lot of, you know, discussion around that because it was fairly, you know, short amount of time between when that actually happened and when we recorded. So there was just a lot of stuff about how, you know, maybe this wasn't a super big surprise to everybody. He'd kind of been moving away from designing Apple products for a while. And the writing was on the wall, people were saying, ever since he became like the chief design officer, which if you notice, like when he left, no one else became the chief design officer.
Yeah, they just kind of like moved a couple people around to different positions and who reports to who, but they never replaced him.
Yeah, so what that makes me think is it was kind of just like a, you know, a fluffy role for him to hold.
They Steve Jobsed him.
Yeah, to keep him around and kind of make him happy for a little bit longer and transition him out of like the everyday kind of operations. So I don't think there's going to be, I guess what this all means, like the big takeaway is that I don't think there's going to be a major, like the next iPhone we see won't have the Johnny Ive touch, because that touch has maybe been fading away for a while now. And the team's been preparing for this sort of a transition.
Yeah. I think people kind of conflated the Johnny Ive and Apple designs together. Obviously, Johnny Ive was very important and crucial to a lot of Apple designs that we know and love today. But also, you have to consider Apple as a company has all of these sets of rules on their design for software and hardware and all of this kind of stuff that they very much set in place and are going to follow. You look at pretty much everything they release. Sometimes they have some clunky stuff, but usually, I mean, look, they have great first generation products for a reason. You look at the Apple Watch, great first generation product. You look at the AirPods, great first generation product. So when you have that steady of a culture of great design, it makes it a lot easier to transition between leadership in that role.
And I think one reason that a lot of people are so focused on, you know, oh, Johnny Ive is leaving, he was this big guy, is because he's the only design guy you ever hear about, right? Yeah. Like, he was just such a public figure because he's been there for so long, was so close with Steve Jobs that, you know, no one really knows the names of the people who are replacing him or, you know, how much stuff they've been doing behind the scenes this entire time. So, I mean, that's just the way big companies work. Like, you're not going to know about those people. So I'm not expecting like a big right turn. You know, I don't think we're going to see super thick MacBooks because Johnny Ive isn't there to make everything thin.
I saw a mock-up with all the, with a MacBook with just about every possible port, but no USB-C.
I don't think he was the one thing forcing Apple to, you know, have its design values. So, there was one of the stranger things I saw was, the Wall Street Journal kind of did this report about how there were, you know, tensions that had built up between Ive and Tim Cook, because Tim Cook's not really a product guy, not really a design guy, more of a business guy, and that there was just like animosity that had grown between them. And so in a, something that I haven't really seen out of a CEO like of Tim Cook's like a stature, there was an email he sent to the Wall Street Journal that was like immediately screenshotted and tweeted that was kind of scathing about how, you know, he said like, this story is absurd, you guys are making stuff up, you know, you're reaching for facts where there isn't any facts, like I have extreme confidence in our team going forward, all this stuff. And so it just kind of showed how like Tim Cook agrees that, you know, people are kind of reaching for straws with a lot of the things they're saying about Johnny Ive's departure and like conclusions they're drawing. But to see him send a tweet like this, you know, I mean, he didn't send the tweet, but he knew it was going to end up on Twitter.
Yeah.
To see him make a statement like this, you know, specifically kind of trying, like, attacking a journalist and a story was just something that I didn't really expect. I don't know. It was definitely notable.
Yeah, Tim Cook is such a passive guy, it kind of seems, so you don't really expect this. One thing I noticed in this email, he has the sent from my iPhone signature still on.
Oh, I didn't see that. That's hilarious.
Like, he's an 80-year-old man who doesn't know how to use email.
Jeez, that's like a choice at that point where they're like...
Yeah, that's a very conscious choice.
Sent from Apple on my iPhone, designed in California.
Yeah, but I'm not going to blame him because I send emails from my account with a special Google signature that I'm just kind of flexing in my emails.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, everyone's got to do it somehow. Okay, so next there was big Huawei follow-up where people, you know, the way it was phrased to me by one of my friends was, oh, did you see the Huawei ban is over, like Trump lifted it? And that was kind of like the immediate reaction, but the more details came out, kind of the less specifics we really know about what is actually happening. So essentially, the Huawei ban was, what that actually meant was Huawei was being placed on what's called the entity list, and it's essentially a list of companies that U.S. companies would need special permission from the government to do business with.
Mm-hmm.
And so this lift on the ban wasn't... them being taken off that list. They're still on the entity list, but what they're saying is that the U.S. Commerce Department will issue licenses to do business with Huawei, like, fairly loosely, and mainly be concerned about, you know, applications of their technology where it's related to national security, they say. Yeah.
So basically this is Windows on laptops, Android on phones. That's going to be what the largest implication of this is.
Yeah, so... I mean, national security, the interpretation a lot of people are taking on that statement is, like, government-related products. And I could see it maybe reaching into, you know, their 5G hardware.
Mm-hmm.
You
know, a lot of their telecom stuff is definitely...
Like, being in the telecom infrastructure might be national security issues, but everyone's expecting this to mean, like, okay, their phones can have Android, you know, their laptops can have Windows. Like
consumer devices, I think this will be basically... saving their consumer division. I don't know if saving is the right word, but it will allow their consumer division to continue as normal.
It'll give them some buffer time. I mean, they stated that this, like, you know, easing of the licenses is temporary, that, you know, they're still working towards a long-term solution, and if they don't find one, it's just going to go back to the way it was, where no one can do business.
And Huawei's supposed to be making their own OS still, right?
Well, and if you're Huawei, this doesn't dissuade you from doing that.
For sure.
You're still on the list. They still... you know, have you on a very short leash. So you got to be prepared for them to revoke that at a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm. And I think earlier this year they said that pretty soon they should be releasing their own OS. I don't know how true that is or if that will ever happen, especially if they get Android back on their phones, or I guess Android is never taken away from them because the 90-day thing hadn't run up yet. But... basically, the big implication here is with consumer technologies and making sure that Americans can still buy those products, American stores can still sell those products, and American companies can still provide software and hardware for those products.
Yeah, so I think that they will move to their own OS eventually, but I think this will probably push that back because it's not as urgent, right? They don't have to push it out the door.
Yeah, it could be interesting seeing with... what Android eventually turns into, seeing how iOS evolves, and then seeing if any other companies actually break into the OS market. Because I think consumers are very much stuck in this little box of iOS versus Android, and they don't really think about any other operating systems. And even when Chrome OS came out, it's not liked by everybody, but it is very much liked by some people. And I think...
heavily used in education.
Yeah, heavily used in education. And I think there are a lot of use cases where having different operating systems on cellular devices could be super useful.
Yeah, there's a topic I've been thinking about like, if, you know, the last whatever years didn't happen in the smartphone industry and you woke up and you had the phones to choose between today, like, what does that world look like? You know, like, where are we really in the state of the actual products that we're buying?
Because
I think it's an interesting topic to look at, like, you know, back when I was first buying my first phones, everyone was talking about, you know, all these Android phones, they have cool software features, but iPhone build quality is above the rest. It's so far above the rest. And then if you look at today, and I'm looking at an iPhone, you know, XS versus the new Galaxy phone, one has a beautiful screen and a great design that makes it look, you know, like it came out a couple years after the other. And so I just think that that whole shift has been interesting, and it's something that we'll definitely be watching, you know, when the new iPhones come out.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things with the development of cell phones, I know we're kind of burying the lead here, but one of the most interesting things about the development of smartphones is how much can change between the fall and spring releases. Because it seems like Google's doing spring releases now. Most of the budget phones do spring releases, and Samsung does a spring release for the S line, and then the Note line is in the fall, lining up with the iPads and the Pixels, or the iPhones and the Pixels. So it's very interesting to see how much of a leap you go from, say, fall of 2018, when you have the Pixel 3 and the iPhone XS and the Note 8? Note 9. And then this spring, when we got the Pixel 3a, absolutely groundbreaking budget phone. Truly, it's one of the most groundbreaking phones we've seen in quite a while, just because of the price point and its build quality. And then we also saw the S10, which is pretty much the most beautiful phone we've ever seen. So it is really interesting to me how much can be developed just between two launch, like a half launch year.
Yeah, so I mean, a little bit of personal device follow-up. My like iPhone 7's battery has kind of been crapping itself. It is not so I had done the battery swap in the past, like a year ago, and it's basically at the point where I swapped it out last time. So I've been relying heavily on, like, you know, my Anker portable chargers to get me through the day. Like, I carry around my backpack, and that's basically all it has in it is my giant power bank. And so it's like, if this was like a iPhone 11 year instead of a XS year we're in right now, I would have probably bought the new phone by now.
Yeah.
But I want to wait to see what that new for design the 11. Is because I know I would immediately regret purchasing it.
That is exactly how I feel. The beta of iOS 13 is killing my battery.
Yeah.
I'm at like 60% by 11 in the morning. It's disgusting. I hate that. But I also carry a 30,000 milliamp hour brick around with me. I keep it at work just so I can charge my phone all day. And then I also want to wait to upgrade until the 11 comes out.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that, you know, I can make it until the fall.
Yes.
I'm hanging in there.
Yep, just a few more months.
Yep. Okay, so let's get into some news. We got some more Apple news. There was some shifts in the MacBook line. So Apple called it an update to their line for the new school season, which makes sense. You know, a lot of people going to high school, college need their MacBooks.
Yes. So,
notable additions, the MacBook Air dropped $100 and they added True Tone to the display.
Yes.
And I mean, it makes, like, the price drop makes sense. Like, they didn't upgrade the CPU or anything. Yeah. They just kind of gave it a new screen, which is nice. I think that if you are a college student who's never going to need to, you know,
program or video edit, really,
if you're not going to video edit it, maybe not photo editing, but you could probably get by and you don't care about, like, playing games on your machine,
the MacBook Air is perfect.
The Air is the move for you, especially because now they're deprecating the 12-inch MacBook, the no fan, the one port,
disgusting 12-inch MacBook. I hate that device so much. I hate it with a burning passion.
Really?
One USB-C port, no fan, it's tiny. I get, like, okay, it's light, whatever.
It's essentially like a iPad laptop hardware thing.
Exactly.
There's no fans like an iPad, one port like an iPad, but it runs macOS and it's a laptop form factor. And so, like, it's amazing portability. Like,
it's what the MacBook Air should have been.
Like, if you're like a, you know, English major, like, or I mean, basically any business major, any major where
you're just if you're writing and reading and not doing any special programs, if you don't have to run anything besides like Chrome,
the web, I mean, and if you don't care about screen size, that thing was a
perfect,
amazing device to be able to set on your desk in class. But I think that, you know, the MacBook Air, you don't lose too much portability.
No.
I mean, it's not insanely portable like the MacBook was, but it's so much more capable.
It's portable enough to fit in a backpack. I mean, the MacBook Pro is portable enough to fit in a backpack. Like, the MacBook Air is a great college laptop.
I mean, every backpack you buy now is designed to be able to fit a 15-inch MacBook Pro.
Exactly. So.
Except maybe the little Fall Raven ones.
Yeah.
And so the other change they did was to the lower-end 13-inch MacBook Pros. Mm-hmm. They added the Touch Bar to all
only
of them.
Only Touch Bar.
Yep. You can only buy MacBook Pros with Touch Bar now. They also did the True Tone thing, and they bumped up the CPU to have more cores, more speed, yep. that sort of thing. Notably, actually, they didn't add any more ports, which is kind of like that machine's biggest limitation, yeah. only having two is kind of rough.
I really like the MacBook Pro 13-inch. I've noticed recently, I thought I loved having a 15-inch mm-hmm. MacBook, but I've noticed that maybe having a smaller one would be kind of nice for a few situations, but two ports just isn't enough for me.
I'm the exact same way. I have a friend, Nick Sisko, who was on the podcast
former guest.
A while ago. He's a Surface user. He's been eyeing the MacBooks, and me and my other friend who have 15 inches are, you know, kind of feeling the size of them a little bit. So we were heavily recommending the 13-inch Escape, just because the Touch Bar is not that useful, save some money.
Yep.
And then it fits on desks in college classrooms.
It does.
So much easier with the 13-inch size.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to buy a laptop right now, I don't know if I would pick 13 or 15-inch just because it's my only computer, so like if I ever, you know, like when Fortnite came out, it was nice to be able to run it on my laptop.
Mm-hmm.
That 13-inch doesn't have like a GPU to handle that. And so, but if you're someone who has, you know, a separate personal computer, like a gaming computer, then go 13-inch for sure.
100%. I think the 13-inch is a great laptop. Also, if you are willing to spend a little bit more money, as a non-power-using person, it's a great laptop.
Yeah, for sure.
It looks good, too. It looks so good.
And you can still buy the non-Touch Bar version in the refurbished store. So if you want to buy that laptop from Apple, I'd do it soon because
those things are going to sell so quick.
I think that there will be a hot item in that store. So that's what we got for the announced changes to the MacBook Pro. But we got some rumored changes.
Yes,
from
the new
boy.
Keyboard.
Yeah, so Ming-Chi Kuo, in a curiously timed rumor, the week that Johnny Ive leaves, they announce changes to the keyboard that basically the huge controversy around the keyboard is that it was kind of form over function, way too thin, and they made all these sacrifices to make it thinner without really producing a reliable product. And so there's just been so many journalists writing stories about how they had their, you know, MacBook Pro crap out on them because... Yeah. You know, they can't type on certain keys. And the reliability of these things have been a huge issue. Something I've noticed in my personal laptop, and I used to say that I really liked the keyboard that was on my laptop, but at work I'm using the newer version of that keyboard, and so now when I go back to the old one, it feels really janky. So I'm pretty mixed on it at the moment. Probably will be trying to use my iPad as much as possible.
Yeah.
But they are saying that they're going to put the keyboard from the Magic keyboard laptop. So
that's a pretty good keyboard.
A very similar Switch design.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also what I use, you know, when I'm not typing on my laptop. So I would definitely be happy to see that. Yeah. I think that is a very agreeable, everyone will be happy to see that. I mean, even if you're someone who likes the butterfly switches that they have right now, it's not too much of a difference to go to the MacBook.
For sure.
Or the Magic keyboard. And you're probably using that keyboard, you know, at your desk anyways, so I don't think anybody could really disagree with that move, and I think it'll make a lot of people very happy and make some of the haters be quiet.
Yeah, so there are like two main concerns with the keyboard. One, the reliability, and two, the feel. So I actually really like the feel. The reliability, big issue. They're completely separate issue, but it is an issue. And then I think it's a good change. Hopefully the new scissor switches will be more reliable.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the feel, a lot of people say they don't like the feel or they complain about it not being ergonomic, but no laptop keyboard is ever ergonomic. It is impossible to have an ergonomic laptop keyboard.
Yeah, I mean, it's fixed on this tiny little rectangle in
front
of you.
It's not a normal typing.
You can't get a
position.
Slant on it or anything like that. I mean,
I've been using like one of the nice ergonomic keyboards that like you rest your hands on this giant thing in your palms, you rest, and it like dips in for your fingers, and it's split down the middle. Super comfortable typing. I go back to this and I feel like my hands are pinched together and my wrists are bending out, but The thing is, even if they change the keyboard, it's not going to get more ergonomic. It might feel like you're pressing a little lighter.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a huge thing for pro users, just the, like, they care more about the ergonomics.
Get a wireless keyboard. It's simple.
Uh-huh. And so for people like us, we're younger, it might not be a huge issue, but there are people who, like, have serious, you know, like, repetitive strain injury stuff.
Oh, where... for sure. And I spend so much time typing. I've played the piano for a while, and I play saxophone. Like, my fingers are bad already. And having an ergonomic keyboard is important, and I definitely need to invest in an ergonomic wireless keyboard, but I've just dealt with the butterfly keys for now.
Yep. So, yeah, that is all I have for that. That keyboard will be coming in the new 16-inch MacBook Pro, people are saying. Minji Kuo also reported that it would be in the new MacBook Air.
Oh.
But I think that that's what, like, the MacBook Air that came out this year.
Oh.
But I think that's what we saw this week, and it definitely doesn't have a new keyboard.
Yeah.
So we might be waiting till next year for the 16-inch MacBook Pro.
Yep.
Which I will also be watching. So when you think about, just to kind of cover the whole, you know, Apple did this update for helping people purchase laptops for college.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about buying a laptop right now,
wait.
I would definitely say wait, because there's this 16-inch thing coming down the pipeline that is going to be the first redesign since like 2016.
Yep. Which is kind of crazy, because I have the early 2017 model of the 15-inch, so it still feels very much new, but kind of crazy to think that it's almost a three-year-old laptop.
Yeah.
And that this design has been there since 2016, which was almost 4 years ago. And so you think about it, you've got the 2011 MacBook Pro, you've got the 2013 and the 2015, all look kind of similar if you don't look that much at ports. And then the 2015 was a little thinner. But then you look and you can very much tell when somebody has a 2016 or later.
Yeah, no backlight.
So I'm very interested to see what happens with this 2020.
Yeah, I'm hoping for like a visual update for sure, just to kind of show us what the future look of the MacBook Pro is. But I think, so if you're someone who's sitting right now, maybe you bought a MacBook Pro in the last couple of years, I wouldn't be too anxious about this new one coming out, because I think it's going to be a good visual refresh. But the biggest change to keep in mind about the MacBook line is the switch to Apple's own CPUs, which I feel like is going to come in the next few years.
Yeah.
It was a more hot topic like 6 months ago. People were constantly talking about how Apple's, you know, not satisfied with what Intel's been providing them.
Yeah.
And, you know, with all the success that they've been having making the processors and the iPads, I think that the next, like, exciting thing to happen to a MacBook, you know, not just like a new cool look, is going to be these new processors coming in.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the competitive landscape right now, I mean, there's nothing super differentiating Macs at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean all Windows laptops are getting really good.
Yeah.
Everyone's doing crazy stuff with portables.
The Dell XPS? Ooh. The Surface line? Amazing.
People are making solid hardware that is able to do, you know, be more flexible than MacBooks right now. And so Apple controlling that essential part of the hardware and, you know, using some of the crazy processes that they've been able to put into the iPads, I think is where we'll see the next big change. And so that might be what I hold out to until I upgrade, depending on, you know, how revolutionary they get with the 16-inch.
Thankfully for us, the MacBook upgrade line has kind of followed our school.
Exactly,
so the 2016 upgrade happened right before we graduated high school, going into college. That's why I ended up getting this MacBook. The next big update, like major update for like their own CPU, will likely happen pretty shortly after we graduate college. It's a very exciting time. They're just doing a great job with so many things.
Yeah, if we're lucky, our first like full-time work laptop will be, you know, the new stuff. So that could be good. Okay, next piece of news. Something that surprised me and excited me more than I thought it was. I don't follow gaming that much. We talk about it sometimes.
Yeah.
The one thing that's excited me a little bit over the past year is the Nintendo Switch. It's very fun. I am a huge fan of a lot of the games. I've played like quite a bit of the new Zelda game. Or it's not really new anymore, but the Switch Zelda game. When it first came out, I was playing it through like emulators on my laptop, I think. And then I borrowed a Switch to take on a train ride, played a lot of it there. So, what Nintendo announced is a Nintendo Switch Lite. So it's a more portable, lighter, smaller, cheaper version of the Nintendo Switch. So What you get is it costs $200 instead of $300, which is a pretty big difference.
Yeah.
And it doesn't connect to TVs, kind of handicapping it, also focusing on the portability side of things.
It is incredibly portable.
Yeah, the Joy-Cons, like the little side controller things, don't detach. Yep. You can still connect to other ones wirelessly, like if you want to play Mario Kart with friends.
Yeah.
But the big thing is, you know, lighter. The display is a little bit smaller. Slightly better battery life, they're saying, just because it's newer stuff. But I think that's a good price point for the Switch. I mean, that's what I would want it to be at now. And if you imagine where it's going to be in a year, you know, you could you could buy a machine for the new Mario Kart for $150.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a very good price point. Very tempting, you know, for college students like us. If you're going on a long trip. Yeah, if you're going on a plane ride, I mean, that's a great plane ride device. You know?
Oh, it really is. So one thing, I really, really like the Switch. I don't own a Switch, but as a device, the Switch is amazing. I think it's one of the most innovative devices we've seen in so long because you can play console-level games on a portable device, which really just it blew my mind from the beginning. Plus, you can play it on a TV. It's super nice. I love the Switch. The Switch Lite... I absolutely love this. It's so cool. It gives me huge vibes from the aesthetic of the actual DS Lite.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
You just look at it and you think, wow, this is just the next DS Lite from whatever it was that those came out, like 2004 or whatever. But I really do like the aesthetic of this. It looks nice and portable, good battery life. I would not be opposed to perhaps dropping a little bit of money once they come out.
Yeah, I mean, I could see if I had some area of my life, you know, like a long commute, like a subway ride to work every morning, that thing's perfect. You
100%.
Know, whip it on the bus, that kind of thing. And I've seen a little bit of that in Seattle, but not too terribly much. So that is coming out on, oh my gosh, I'm the worst with numbers a month, is 9 August?
9 is September.
It's coming out on September 20th of this year, so fairly soon. Okay, yep, so... next, we got our first look at using Face ID and Touch ID on the web.
I saw this. Beta.
Did you go to that website? You
should
check it out because you're running the new stuff.
I am.
So basically, the first instance of being able to use Touch ID to sign in on websites on Safari has happened. Apple's doing it on their iCloud.com. You can use Face ID. It looks like Andre might be doing it right now.
That was really quick.
Yeah, to sign into your iCloud ID on the web.
That was awesome.
And so that process replaces the annoying get your code from another device and put it into the PIN box.
It's 2FA. It's also you don't have to like press passwords or would you like to use the saved password for this site. It just immediately was like, we're going to check your face. We know it's your face. Cool, we're done.
Yeah, so the idea is that any website can implement the sign in with Apple stuff, and you could sign into any website that supports that just as easily as signing into your phone. I mean, I think that is pretty huge, and you know, Apple definitely has enough market share to make something like that happen. Yeah. It works, you know, on iPhone, iPad, and Mac OS.
Mm-hmm.
On Mac OS, if you have the Touch Bar, you can use the Touch ID for it.
Yeah. With sign in with Apple coming to new iOS apps as well, I think that it will really enable 2FA on apps just super easily.
And I just want to get out of the terrible dance of using saved passwords from the keychain.
Like, yes.
I don't even want to know, because...
My keychain is so full of just random passwords.
Uh-huh.
Like, I know they're all a variation of the same password I use, because even though I'm a tech guy, I don't use secure passwords.
Yeah, and we talked about it before. Like, I used to use the exact same password on everything, and then that password got found somehow, and someone took my accounts on almost everything. And so... Since that happened, I use these long auto-generated passwords, and using Apple's built-in keychain thing sucks. Like, I would so much rather just Touch ID.
Yeah, I use too many devices to decide that I want to use keychain. Three of my devices are Apple and have that keychain, but I also have my work laptop and my work desktop, and sometimes I want to log in on those, and if
exactly.
I don't know what my password is, it makes it a lot more difficult.
Yep, and so... Most people solve that problem by just
using the same password.
And so if at least in your apps that are on your phone, you can use, you know, your phone's biometric stuff.
Yeah.
Then that's a big win.
Yeah. Your face is the most secure password you can have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next thing we have, did you ever see the stories about people storing data on DNA?
Maybe?
I don't know. This is like, it's one of the like coolest parts of like innovative technology stuff, you know, the bleeding edge that I've heard about in the last couple of years. So essentially there is all this hubbub about research where scientists were figuring out how to store digital information on DNA. So like you imagine a photo stored on DNA. There's some advantage of that. It's way more dense than the technology we use right now. You know, you could store a ton of data in a very small space.
Yeah.
And so it's obviously very complicated. And there was news this week that a DARPA-funded research group found a way to store data using a similar process, but using much simpler molecules. So the breakthrough is that, you know, you're not using super complicated DNA. You're using simpler, like, sugars. And amino acids doesn't mean much to me, but if they're saying it's simpler, that's cool. So the idea is that they're smaller and you can store even more dense than you can on DNA. And so when you imagine, like, what does this mean? Obviously, in the future, if, like, reading and write speeds to this sort of thing can get fast enough, then storage can become even more condensed than we have right now. And the hard drive is still, you know, a fairly large part of most devices. So shrinking that's a big deal. But the really cool aspect of it is like kind of big data storage. So the way that works right now is you have these drives that require power. And the advantage of something like this where it's stored on an actual molecule is that once they're kind of written to and configured, you don't keep them powered on. Like they're molecules. They exist in the way that they exist.
They exist physically as data rather than as the memory.
Yep. And so there's, you know, nothing stopping you from, let's say, if I want to do a backup of, you know, the Internet Archive, like a giant repository of like saved websites, you could write all of that to some sort of a DNA-based storage system. And then just put it in cold storage and leave it there for 30 years, not have to worry about powering it, that sort of thing. And so there's advantages on that. So it's kind of, it could allow people to do things more locally instead of relying on the cloud for that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
The big barriers around it are still like figuring out how to actually, you know, interface quickly with this sort of a storage system. But I think it's a really cool idea that, you know, when it was DNA, it's like, the way our data is stored as organisms can be used to store, you know, the data that we also use on our computers.
Yeah.
And these molecules show that, like, it doesn't even take stuff as complicated as DNA. Like, we can just use other things like that. I don't know. It's a cool area of research for sure.
Yeah. So if you think about how much data is stored in your brain, right? You're not actively powering every part of your brain at all times, but you can still reach back and have a thought or a memory. So if we are able to condense as much data as is held in a human brain into the size of a human brain and make that accessible. Obviously, it's not going to be like brain molecules, but it's essentially that that process of using DNA to store things. It makes it much more human-like. It's very much a Turing machine-esque approach to memory. So if you are able to have that memory and store that much data as you do in your memories, that's amazing. Now the only thing we need to do is make it so you can access that as much as quickly as you can access a memory, right? It doesn't take you long to just have a thought. It's instant. But that's not possible at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the way you do reading and writing to this sort of thing would be a lot different than you would do it to the storage that we have now.
Exactly.
So that's got to be a interesting area of research, I would say.
Yes.
Okay, the last thing I have is not really a story. It's kind of another category of buzz I've been hearing, and it kind of came back recently. Did you ever hear about Superhuman? Did we talk about Superhuman?
I don't think so.
So Superhuman is an email app that charges $30 a month. What does that make you think?
That makes me think it is overpriced no matter what.
So Superhuman is also kind of a status symbol in you know, tech elite, or I mean, like, kind of the startup world. So they, you know, it's called Superhuman. It's an email app on the web and Mac and iOS. They do all sorts of crazy things. Like, if you imagine the cool stuff that Gmail does, where it's like auto reply, you know, you type in a meeting time, it shows you your calendar for that sort of thing. It's like that on steroids. Like everything you touch is just covered in like, you know, oh, do you want to send this message tomorrow morning? You know, remind me about this. Here's the person you're emailing's LinkedIn information.
Yep. AI triage automatically sort your most important emails. Invite only.
Yeah, so it's an invite-only app. They have, I want to say, like 15,000 users right now. So that's a decent amount of people paying $30 a month. But they're raising crazy amounts of money. Like, I think their most recent round was $30 million, which is insane for an app with 15,000 users. But the reason they only have 15,000 users is because part of their marketing strategy is how exclusive it is.
It's like the Supreme of email apps.
Sure, yeah, it's kind of like the Supreme of email apps. And it's that thing that, you know, you were talking about. You want to talk about the ultimate status symbol? There's a little signature that comes when you use Superhuman.
Oh.
So there you go. Now when you do it, everyone knows you're, you know, that guy.
Yeah.
And the process of getting on it, you know, you get on a wait list. The only way you really get in is if you know someone. And so if you get put to the front of the wait list, then you do a questionnaire, and if you answer it correctly, then you go through a 30-minute product walkthrough or an hour-long product walkthrough that's often with the CEO of the company. So it's just like this whole thing, right, around I am a, you know, super – I'm a thought worker, and I spend all my time in my email, and I'm going to spend this money to make that better. And this company that is kind of found this – new way of marketing around elitism. And so it's just been interesting to see the stories that come out, because every time it comes out, it's like you'll see this journalist and it's like, oh, maybe they're going to take a judgy tone to it. And then halfway through the article, they're like, yeah. And so I talked to some friends and I got on the app and it's amazing and I love the app and it's great. So everyone really only sings the praises of this thing in terms of how great it is. And a lot of the features that they have raised privacy issues with some people, but it really is like, oh, they have done a significant change to email. And it's just crazy to me that, you know, a bigger company like Google or other smaller email apps, there's plenty of email applications on the App Store that are run by decent-sized teams, aren't doing features like this. And that they're able to pull this off, you know, have a unique set of features and be able to gather so much public attention as an email app.
Yeah.
Is just something that's really crazy and has been really weird to watch play out.
Yeah, I mean, it's very strange how a company like this can just kind of take a grasp of this elite email user market. And I mean, obviously you think about Gmail. I mean, that's what my mind goes to, Gmail and Outlook. You would think these are things they could implement. Right.
Yeah. But, I mean, Gmail especially, they do a lot of smart features.
But then it does raise some privacy concerns, right? Mm-hmm. Like if it's going to tell you everything about the person that's emailing you, do you have their consent to do that? Is that consent required?
Yeah. I mean, it's like stuff like that is there's lookup based on their email on LinkedIn. That's not the crazy stuff. The crazy stuff is more around like, you know how when you get newsletters, they can track if you opened it or not.
Yeah.
It's like using that on your personal email. So technology that'll tell you if they've seen it, stuff that lets you unsend emails, like kind of bringing nicer features to email that require hacky, you know, tracking-y ways of doing this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that the story here is kind of more around the interesting marketing of it. And I don't know. It's just been really fascinating to see. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool. $30 a month. That's insane.
That is.
And they're like, oh, no, like, you shouldn't use this unless you spend, like, at least 3 hours in your email a day. Like, stuff like that. Like, I don't know. It'll be weird to see if they ever actually try to scale it up. And obviously, they're raising all this money, so that's the plan. So if they end up dropping that $30 a month and going big, it would be, I don't know. Like, can they really disrupt Gmail?
Yeah.
We'll see.
We'll have to see.
That is all we got from the news. We will be back with our main topic on government face privacy. All right. And we are back with our main topic about privacy concerns around government facial recognition.
Yes.
It doesn't sound very exciting. It's kind of a mouthful, but it's a pretty interesting area, and I keep hearing about it, so I was like, gosh dang it, I'm going to figure out what the heck people keep talking about.
Yeah, this is one of the like high-tech kind of things that you see in political news, which is very strange because it doesn't happen all the time. It's usually like hacking and malware, but this is one of the things that I think was developed in good faith and then misused by the government, and I think that it's very important that we have legislation for it.
And so when we look at facial recognition and the current state of the technology, you know, when you think facial recognition and the government things, you might think like, oh, TV shows where, you know, you can track people and that sort of thing.
Zoom and enhance.
Zoom and enhance, you know, show me that face. Oh, yes. Search him up, that sort of thing. And I mean, that's not super far off from the state of modern technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have facial recognition that is extremely accurate in the palm of our hands with Face ID, and we have, you know, more processing power at the disposal of anybody who wants it than has ever been available with the cloud. So this sort of idea of very accurately attempting to process a ton of information and, you know, keep tabs on everything you're processing is not something that's coming. It's something that's here.
Yeah, all you need is an algorithm at this point, and that can be written.
And it has been written, and you can buy it. And so there's a lot of talk right now around the implications of this technology and what we can do to maybe prevent it from getting its roots in any farther than it already has. And there are a lot of interesting facets to this, so we are going to dive in by talking about the two issues that come up when you talk about facial recognition technology, and especially as it relates to the government and surveillance. So first is bias. This is something that comes up frequently when you're talking about machine learning algorithms like this.
Yeah, this is especially big with Face ID. When Face ID first came out, its bias really showed. You have this kind of trend with facial recognition technology where darker skin tones are not noticed as well because of the way that they prefer to use light over depth sensors, as a main heuristic to figure out which face is looking at the camera. So it doesn't work as well for darker skin tones, which is a huge problem.
And so when we're talking about the government using facial recognition technology, it's almost always light-based sensors because it's like, you know, traffic cameras, that sort of thing. And so that issue is inherent to the way that they're trying to use this. And less, you can imagine a world where less accurate results for minorities who are already being biased towards in a lot of these systems would lead to, you know, that would be a multiplier on the issue of being misidentified and being incorrectly incriminated in something like this.
Yeah, so you have a police force with a commonly found bias against people of color, and I'm not saying that all police are bad or racist. What I'm saying is that there have been studies that, especially in certain police districts, there are certain places where the police tend to bias against people with darker skin. And it doesn't help when you have technology that is built with a bias against people with darker skin, because then that biased police force compounds with this biased technology that can create a major problem in misidentification that can be used as evidence.
Yeah, so the two parts of this bias are exactly what you're saying. It's first that the technology itself has been proven in a lot of studies to have issues around skin tone. And the second part is that in a biased system, this technology only automates that bias and makes it more efficient at being biased.
Yes.
Because, you know, let's say if you're in an area where the percentage of mugshots that are of darker skin tone is extreme, well then, you know, that's the data that they're matching faces against. Yeah. So the amount of false positives on people of that skin tone is going to be much higher.
Yes.
And so all of these issues are a huge facet of people's problem with facial recognition. And it's a shortcoming of not just the technology, but also the people who will be using it. And so, I mean, in an ideal world, right, like, there's the solution to this is the technology gets better, as technology always does.
Yeah.
And we don't have the problems in our law enforcement that we do, which isn't really the technology's fault when you think about
it. No, it isn't.
But that's not the world we live in right now. And so that's why this issue is so common when you're looking at, like, why people like the ACLU are pushing for restrictions around the ways this technology can be used.
Exactly. And another thing here is that when you have these misidentifications of people with darker skin, just imagine that as if you were, you had made some mistake that had caused the police to have your fingerprints on record so they knew who you were. Mm-hmm. And then they're dusting for prints at a major crime scene, right? And they say, hey, these prints are an exact match to yours, but they actually aren't. But when you present that to a jury, all a jury knows is that the prosecution is saying this is an exact match based on science.
Yep.
Right? That's exactly what they're saying with this facial recognition technology. They're using it as a be-all end-all for saying, oh, that's who it is, which then leads to more confrontations with people of color, and a lot of times that's when the police station or the police department's bias can come in, is yeah. within those confrontations.
And I mean, the one thing I want to point out that you said, I mean, it's not the be-all end-all right now. There's nobody yes. that's using this as hard evidence, like fingerprints, right now. But the idea is that it's all moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And as we'll get into, there's companies pushing this technology on governments, and that is where it's heading. And
yes.
so that is what a lot of people are trying to prevent from happening. Because, like you said, you know, if, you know, the fingerprinting system was biased towards people with big hands.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
There'd be a lot of people pissed off about,
yeah.
you know, getting called into court and having what everyone, what to looks like everybody else is indisputable evidence. You know, you
yeah.
feel like a crazy person.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same thing could happen. You know, the jury could be looking at a blurry picture of something that they can barely distinguish as a face, but the computer says, no, I detected it. It's
exactly.
you. You're going to jail.
And unfortunately, like, a lot do? Of people trust computers, as much as it's an issue, especially with how software is developed and how software teams are built. If you remember when we talked to Jerron Petty about minorities and technology, we talked about this a little, about how it, to reduce bias, it is very important that you have diverse engineers working on these products.
And so one of the issues inherent to the technology is when you get to a point where, let's say, if I was, like, incorrectly identified as a person who the police were looking for because of some sort of a crime, and I was, like, falsely incarcerated or something like that.
Yeah.
There's, and if they realized it was a problem, there's nothing they could do to look into the algorithm and
yes.
see why it made that
it's
decision.
It's all behind the scenes. And on top of that, it's made that decision, which then becomes a part of its decision-making process.
Uh-huh. And so the, like, the high-level thing is just that the way systems like facial recognition work is it's, like, just a convoluted set of decisions that are trying to, it works kind of like the way your brain works, where it's just a random set of connections.
Yep.
And eventually it can build a model where it can start to recognize these sort of things. But you can't look in that and say, like, oh, I see the problem. It's because it's set to, you know, if the skin tone's this dark, then we're gonna, like, increase the likelihood of that. It's like, you could never look into it and correct for those things. And that is where a huge part of, like, machine learning research is in right now.
Yes.
Is trying to increase that visibility. But that's just not there.
Yeah.
And so it makes fixing issues around this technology impossible at the
moment. It's impossible without remaking and retraining the algorithm and the model.
And if you're working with biased data, you're always going to get biased results.
Exactly.
So there's all sorts of areas that are scary when it comes to this stuff. And
mm-hmm.
so it's good that it's not being, you know, 100% fully used right now. It's still in testing phases for
yeah.
the most part. In America. We'll get into
yes.
China later. But yeah, so this that's concern number one, is the bias that's inherent with this technology and the system that it's being used in. Concern number two is, let's say there's no bias issues. It's 100% accurate all the time. We don't have to worry about that sort of thing. That in and of itself is a horrifying situation.
Yeah, it's Big Brother.
Because at that point, it's 100% Big Brother. You know, we already have, I think the number is like 50 million like public cameras in the U.S.
Yeah.
Cops are pushing Nest doorbell. Ring doorbells. They're even like subsidizing them for some neighborhoods. Ooh. Because if a crime happens, then you know they can request the footage.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And if that, like, if you know, if that keeps going farther and further, we keep getting, you know, smart security systems with cameras on them. Mm-hmm. You know, you can imagine a world where there's more cameras than people, and I mean there already is if you consider smartphones, but
yeah,
I mean cameras that the government can use to track people. You get into a situation where you know, there's already technology that can detect if, you know, maybe someone's stressed out emotionally. Maybe they take that further, you know, analyze your behavior. They've been watching you all day. See, maybe you're showing signs of someone who might be about to make an irrational choice. You know, maybe they get you on committing some sort of a pre-crime crime where you haven't even done anything yet.
Yeah.
Or maybe they get you on doing something that's, you know, a First Amendment right,
yeah,
but you're disagreeing with the government and they're going to shut you down because of it. It's just, yeah, it's technology that in America, people don't believe the government should have. It's what, yeah, our country's based on. And so there has been a lot of push against governments being allowed to use this at all because of that.
Yeah, nobody wants to be arrested on intent to loiter, right?
And no one wants the government to be able to watch where you are at every moment.
Yeah.
I mean, there's trade-offs, right? You know, if in a perfect world it deters all crime.
Yeah.
But if that comes at the cost of not being able to go against the government, not being able to protest, that sort of thing, because the government, you know, has this all-seeing power, you, yeah, can't act against it. It's a real, you know, moral situation that you get into that is not something that we should just ignore.
Yeah,
you know?
And I mean, I completely support private cameras that point completely to private property as, mm-hmm, security, right? That is super great. That's super important. And if the owner of that footage wants to provide it to law enforcement, that is A-okay. I don't think that private footage from private property can be requested by the government. I don't think it should be able to be just taken without like a warrant or an express necessity for it. And also I think that you shouldn't be able to have cameras pointing at public property, even if it's the street out front of your house, right? Because if you think about it, in a lot of cities in suburban areas where a lot of like white flight has happened, it's a lot less common to see people of color in these neighborhoods just because of a whole bunch of geopolitical issues, right? There's just a lot more white people in certain neighborhoods and a lot less people, yeah, of color in those neighborhoods. And it brings to mind an episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine where the sergeant who is played by Terry Crews is stopped in his own neighborhood. He doesn't have his badge or anything. And he's stopped while he's looking for his daughter's toy in the street in a primarily white neighborhood. He's stopped by a white cop who actually he outranks in, yeah, the NYPD. But essentially the issue here is that he's in a public place. There's no issue with him being there, right? So I think if you have cameras pointing at public property, it could lead to a lot of people saying, oh, I don't like how fishy that person looks just standing on the street. That's nobody's place.
I mean, that's... what's this app called? The neighborhood app.
Oh yeah, the neighborhood Nextdoor app on steroids. Nextdoor, yeah.
Yeah, that's Nextdoor culture, right?
Like, yes.
They're, you know, jokes to most people coming out of Nextdoor about like, oh, saw a suspicious man in hoodie in my neighborhood. But like, yeah, that's what people are doing.
Yeah.
But what you're saying would kind of, you know, you're not comfortable with Ring doorbells then. Because that's the yeah, whole thing is like, you can see who's at the door, but also it's like a camera pointing at the street.
Yeah, I think it's not a terrible idea to have a video or a smart doorbell. I don't think that they should be able to use that footage of a public place as any to try to report a crime, gotcha, or anything like that.
The big thing we're really talking about here is like traffic cameras,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Because those already exist,
mm-hmm,
and they're already a big enough network where they could do some serious tracking. Yep. And they already have the footage. It's not like they have to do anything to get the footage. Theoretically, there's nothing stopping them from doing this.
Yeah.
Except regulations that could possibly exist in the future.
And this is, again, where bias comes back. Because if a model is trained to say, oh, people with darker skin are more likely to be criminals just because of different reasons as to why there are more people of color incarcerated and with mugshots, and that's what it's being trained on.
Yeah.
If it's only being trained on criminals or convicted criminals or mugshots, people with mugshots, it's just a higher likelihood than reality that it will think a person of color is a criminal, and thus if it tries to match a face in a car and it mismatches that face as a criminal, it will pull those records, it will do all of this stuff, and it just has that implicit bias to it.
Yep. Okay, so back on the mass surveillance issues, if like, you know, it's perfect world, no bias, there's still the issue where if all this information is kept around, you know, here's all this footage we have with all the related faces to it in the government storing it somewhere. I mean, we don't trust the government to not have data breaches for the most part.
Oh, yeah. It goes about of mistrusted tech entities. It goes Facebook, then the government.
Yeah. And that's really a new development, Facebook passing them. So the government having the sort of information, you know, on where you are at all times, basically, even if you don't have an issue with them knowing that for like freedom reasons, there's still the idea that if that's there, bad actors will somehow get access to it. And bad actors knowing where you are, or, you know, if you're a more, you know, likely to be targeted person, it's a much bigger issue for you. Like, oh, even if, you know, someone can sell that information, figure out when you're not home, that sort of thing, it's like there's just so many issues around that data existing at all.
Yeah.
And the government being the steward of that data, that it is a huge concern. So, I mean, mass surveillance in general, not great. Not something I'm a fan of. Would prefer if, you know, we never got to the Big Brother state.
There's a whole genre of books and television and movies about this exact thing.
And that genre is actually real life, called China right now.
Yes.
So there's been some of the most interesting articles on this topic are on the fact that China is already doing it. And they're already have 200 million cameras up, and they're already running facial recognition on everybody that drives down the street, and they're already using it to stop crimes like jaywalking and robberies and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so there's just, you know, crazy stats like the 200 million cameras so far. There was a test that there was a story about where there was some reporter they were trying to find because he'd committed some crime with something he published. And within 7 minutes, they found him in a crowd at a concert that had 60,000 people there. They picked him out of the crowd because of all the information they had just from him being in public in China. And so, I mean, there's even the police are working on special AR glasses like Google Glass they can wear to overlay, you know, information that they have on a face over the faces of people, at border stations, so they can see who's in the system and who's not.
They're turning their cops into superheroes.
It's exactly like all this stuff is insane. Nearly all of their citizens are in these facial recognition databases. There's a story that half U.S. adults are in some sort of a government facial recognition database in the U.S.
Oh man,
China's, I mean, that's scary. China's already all the way there, pretty much. If you see videos of it, it's really crazy. Like, you're driving down the street and you're at night, you're blinded by the flash of the cameras taking pictures of you. Like, it's to an insane degree. Like, it's the degree that we were talking about all this stuff could go in America. It's already there, and the stories on it are just, they're just crazy. And so, in cases like China, there's obviously, they don't, you know, give a lot of visibility into their numbers. But the UK has been experimenting with similar facial technology for like a couple decades now. And their experience and some of the numbers that they've put out around the sorts of research is that it's really good at finding the person, obviously.
Yeah.
They have all this information. But the way it kind of works is like, let's say you're looking for someone, you get a few positive hits where it's like, okay, we think these four people are the guy. and we think these few thousand people have a high probability of being the guy.
Yeah.
And so the case that should scare people is that if you're one of those people in that group of thousands of people that they're like, this is probably the guy, you know,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden you're involved in something like that and you have a higher likelihood of being falsely incriminated.
Yeah.
Because you were driving down the street in public and your government has a bunch of cameras on you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you look at the other stuff that this has given China, their move into facial recognition, there are places where you can check out at grocery stores using your face, pay with your face,
yeah.
And get on the subway using your face, that sort of thing. And so that's the type of thing that will sell this technology, right? Like,
yeah.
The convenience of it will make it more prominent. And that's the reason why there has to be some sort of regulation to be like, yeah, we
for
know
sure.
There's facial recognition cameras everywhere. It needs to be illegal for the government to use it to track everybody.
Yeah, 100%. It's just one of those things where you really do need careful, well-thought-out legislation. Unfortunately, I don't know how great the U.S. federal government would be at implementing this. San Francisco has banned the use by government agencies. The state of Oregon just banned the use of it. Facial recognition technology by government entities like the FBI and ICE. And I really think that not only do just regular American citizens not want this, the people who develop these technologies don't want that.
Yeah, so when you look at the companies that are providing this technology to the government, the big one is Amazon. They have a product called Recognition that's famous for, you know, they sell it to governments.
Yeah.
They sell it to local governments to use for exactly the type of stuff we're talking about. But Microsoft and IBM are also big players in the space. And I feel like there was a while there where every week we're seeing a story of, like, you know, Amazon workers protest the use of their technology by ICE. Like,
yeah.
There are all these people pushing back against, you know, ICE and specifically, like, areas like that of the government,
yeah.
Border Patrol, using their technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it develops into, you know, a broader push around, like, hey, let's not sell these to the government.
Yeah.
I don't know where they think it's going, if it's not going to the government in some sort of way. I mean, there's not a lot of people that have use cases for tracking on a broad scale like that.
No.
But
I mean, maybe it becomes a part of AWS when if you need a specific part of that facial recognition technology, if you want to implement your own Amazon Go style checkout.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
There are definitely use cases for it. And I think that's what people are thinking about. These tech workers, the engineers, everybody really associated with creating these things, when they are creating them, almost everybody wants to help people, right? Like, I know that we're both tech workers. It may seem a little biased from us, but at least I know that Jacob and I, when we create technologies, want to create that technology to help people. And I really do think that facial recognition technology has a place in the world as a technology that helps people, but it can also, it walks a very fine line when it comes to that. So mm-hmm. I think it's very important that we understand that engineers are working to make it for that good cause. Unfortunately, a lot of companies and governments kind of want to collaborate to use it for other reasons.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure that's where the giant profits are. So just the way it works out, this stuff is going to happen if there isn't regulation.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd be curious to see another take on it that's like, here's why we don't need this regulation. But I don't know. Until then, that's what I'll be watching for, to see which route that's going down, because
for sure.
It's definitely a hot area right now.
We will definitely have some follow-up in the future on
this. I mean, San Francisco just passed that bill in May. I'm sure a lot of cities are thinking about it after mm-hmm. they did it. And so there will be a lot happening on this over the next year or two.
Yeah.
And it will be I'll be curious to see which way we go.
Yeah.
Especially at a federal level. But yeah.
Yeah. You got anything else on that?
That is all I got for the episode.
All right. You can contact us on Twitter at HackersPod. Send us an email at hackerslackerpod@gmail.com. You can send us an Anchor voice message now. That's pretty cool. And we would love to hear from you all the time. We'll try to keep the Twitter account a little bit more active. But that's all for this week. We will talk to you next week.
Bye.